next case is 96-1953, Metro Health Medical Center versus Hoffman LaRoche. Mr. Walters.
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, my name is Stephen Walters, and it's my privilege to represent the petitioner in this matter, Metro Health Medical Center. Metro Health is the county hospital for Cuyahoga County, Ohio. This matter that brings us together today, as the court is aware, is a certification of state law question by the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Ohio Eastern Division. Judge Nugent has presented two questions, requesting the responses of the court. The action in which the questions are generated is an action for contribution brought by Metro Health against the defendant therein, the respondent herein, Hoffman LaRoche. Hoffman LaRoche is a pharmaceutical company from New Jersey. It is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Swiss pharmaceutical company from Basel, Switzerland. The underlying case, of course, as there always is an underlying case in a contribution action, is a, or was, a wrongful death action in Cuyahoga County Common Pleas Court brought by the estate of Linda Carr, a 39-year-old woman who died in September of 1987. I'd like to take just a moment to talk briefly about that case because it sheds some light on the way these types of cases evolve and why I believe the position asserted by the petitioner is important. I'd like to reserve, if I may, 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Linda Carr was brought into the emergency room at Metro in very bad shape. She was an unfortunate woman who had a long history of diabetes, of gastrointestinal bleeding, gastric ulcers. This is not the first time she has been through these sorts of crises. A procedure called a gastroscopy was performed, and that, as I believe your honors know, is a diagnostic procedure of the entry of a tube or scope through the esophagus into the stomach, and it provides an opportunity for not only diagnostic capability, but also for treatment, to find the source of bleeding and to treat it. During the course of that procedure, the patient was given a drug known as Versed. Versed was a drug that had been on the market in the U.S. for approximately a year or less at the time of this incident. Versed was manufactured and sold by Hoffman LaRoche. Versed is a drug for conscious sedation. It has amnesic properties. The patient forgets the discomfort that they went through. Linda Carr unfortunately suffered a respiratory...
Counsel, you probably want to just get to the law because we aren't really familiar with the facts. Is
the death of Linda Carr in September of 1987 led to a wrongful death action. In that action, Metro Health, several of its physicians were sued, as well as a company called Roche Biomedical Laboratories, which is a subsidiary of the respondent here.
I'll just get to a question, counsel. I know your arguments, but you know the 2307.31B can be read to set forth the criteria for bringing a contribution action against the drug company in this case. Why shouldn't we read that as the requirement you must meet, which is extinguished their claim?
I'm not suggesting that you engraft any language on that subsection, that you ignore any language in that subsection. I'm suggesting that you read it exactly the way objection is that there is an intent to avoid double exposure or double liability. In a situation in which there has been a settlement and a release entered into, the framers of this statute, this statute is part of the Uniform Contribution Among Tortfeasors Act, the UCATA, the framers of this undoubtedly intended to make sure that a tortfeasor who settles with an injured plaintiff is settling the entire case, that there can be nothing else that the potential contributor who may be sued in a contribution action may have to pay. That's the meaning of that language. That's the meaning of that language as indicated in a fine opinion by the Franklin County Common Pleas Court of Appeals in the Henry versus Consolidated Stores case. But I have no problem at all with that language.
But if the co-defendant is already out of the case, they're already immune from suit, they no longer have any potential for any collusion or liability. That term does not serve them to that type of defendant, is it?
I would respectfully disagree. The language in the statute is intended, I believe, to be all-encompassing. In a situation in which a defendant in an action such as this is no longer capable of having a wrongful death action prosecuted against it by reason of expiration of the wrongful death statute, is nevertheless should be subject to contribution. This is so abundantly clear, I would suggest, by a reading of the statute in its full context, and that is reading both point 3.1 and point 3.2. There is one statute of limitations. It's a one-year statute of limitations. Whether the tortfeasor that ultimately seeks contribution has settled with the victim or has been the subject of judgment, they have 1 year from that point in time to enforce their rights of contribution. The extinguishment portion of section 2307.31b is a provision that's intended to protect against being sued more than once. The obvious situation that one can see, and this case is not far from, but the obvious situation that one can see is where on the day before the statute of limitations run, the plaintiff sues tortfeasor A. The statute of limitations runs the next day. The obvious fault is tortfeasor B. Is there nothing that can be done because the underlying statute of limitations is run? I think that in the Henry case, it was well said that the contribution claim is derivative of the plaintiff's injury claim, but it is not dependent upon it. And the diligence or lack of diligence of a plaintiff's attorney cannot be used as a bar against an action over a contribution by a settling tortfeasor. If we were to read into this statute the position urged by the respondent, it would suggest that a different treatment needs to be used for tortfeasors who go through trial and suffer judgment at the hands of a jury for the plaintiff's claim. Those tortfeasors would be permitted to file an action for contribution within 1 year against another tortfeasor. But those who settle would not. The logical conclusion from that is that the position urged by the respondent would discourage settlement. It would force defendants like Metro Health to go through trial. It would force plaintiffs like the Carr Estate to go through trial. With all due respect, that's silly. That's something that is in the interest only of those tortfeasors who wish to avoid accountability for what they do, who wish to hide behind corporate shells. In the last 20 years, we've seen this state a lot of polarization between those who would advocate on behalf of injured parties and those who would advocate on behalf of insurance companies or defendants. In this case, this issue that the petitioner urges is one that I think is an issue on which both plaintiffs and defendants agree. We don't want unnecessary litigation. We want the ability to get to the correct particular case, I should note that there was no Civil Rule 54B certification, so there's some question about the finality of the underlying judgment. But whether or not that is true, MetroHealth followed the recipe. They settled. They named specifically Hoffman LaRoche in the release, and then within the one-year limitation period, filed their action against Hoffman LaRoche. They have followed that recipe, and they deserve to have their day in court in the U.S. District Court.
Does your rule, the way you want the rule read, I should say, only apply if, well, let me backtrack. Normally, the defendant has defenses, and so they're excused in the case or dismissed out, or judged out, whatever. You settle, you go after them. You're saying basically that their defenses against the plaintiff aren't necessarily defenses against your claim.
That's precise.
Are you basically just limiting this to a statute of limitations issue and not other types of defenses that they would have against the plaintiff?
I am expressly limiting it to defenses that would affect the ability of the plaintiff and let's call it the victim, to prosecute their claim. It would not apply to defenses, for example, like sovereign immunity. It would not apply to any defenses that existed at the time of the injury. It does apply to defenses that may be acquired later on that would become an impediment or a bar to the enforcement by the victim of the victim's rights against the would-be contributor.
Okay, so you're drawing a distinction between...
I am indeed. Any other defenses are defenses that can be brought at time of trial of the contribution action, and may be the basis for a dispositive motion. I should indicate that, for example, there has been in the briefing some argument about the applicability of the concept of res judicata. Well, that has no place here. We are not arguing in this action, in this contribution action, whether or not the plaintiff's, the estate's claim against Hoffman LaRoche was barred by the statute of limitations. It apparently was. We're past that. That's not part of the contribution action. And I would suggest...
Is that how you handle the raising of the Parkman versus Grava case by your opponent? You say that it's inapplicable
it's a separate issue. They're trying to shift that issue to us. It's a separate issue and we don't care. It just doesn't matter. I've listed in the brief the aspects of what needs to be followed to pursue successfully contribution action. The fundamental immunity is, of course, the immunity of the tortfeasor himself. In this case, I represent the tortfeasor who settled with the victim. Nothing else matters, however.
Well, there is one thing else that matters. You have to release everybody in the release.
That's
the condition preceding.
That's absolutely
that was done here.
Yeah, that was done here. And if we look at the various cases that have been decided, that they tend to turn on whether or not there was a specific naming in the release of the all four pieces.
Matter of fact, those were the issues raised, I think, in the cases cited by the other side. Mostly the question was whether or not the tortfeasor number two in this case was released by the release.
That's exactly
as opposed to the contribution, opposed to the statute of limitations having run.
That's exactly so.
Well, otherwise, don't you, they'll get a chance to respond to this, but you really let a plaintiff control a cause of action for contribution.
If we were to adopt the respondent's position, that is so. And the plaintiff, perhaps in the best faith possible, may not be privy to sufficient information to control at that point.
Yeah, but for whatever reason they do it, logistical, trial, strategy, whatever it might be, they might just not affect service on the defendant, tortfeasor too.
There could be a number of different reasons, Your Honor.
And then that controls your right of contribution according to that side that we'll hear in a minute.
Yes, and I don't believe that that's the intention of the framers of the UCATA, and Ohio has adopted the UCATA essentially word for
Thank you, Mr. Walters. Mr. Marcus.
Sets forth who can file contributions. contribution.
Yes.
And then G, of course, says that even where no judgment, whether or not judgment has been entered in an action against two or more tortfeasors for the same injury, blah, 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 contribution may be enforced by separate action. Now, I'm wondering about your response to the proposition that Section B is important to the situation where a tortfeasor enters into a settlement with the claimant, as you highlighted, as opposed to situations where that didn't happen. And this only sets forth, as the other side argues, that where there's been a settlement, you darn well better make sure that the claimant's out of it before you try to seek contribution from a joint tortfeasor.
Okay, first, Justice Cook, there are different provisions in the statute for judgment, basis for contribution, and settlement, basis for contribution. Those are deliberate. They're not accidental. They result from a variety of measurement of different policy concerns. And I think that the court should not easily wander to the other issues before they are fully before the court. As to the question you raised about, I'm sorry, say it again.
I was starting with G. Does G not suggest that B is for one situation?
That the statute is attempting to deal with both the overwhelmingly more common contribution cases where no lawsuit has ever been filed. 90% of all the contribution cases arise when the motor vehicle insurer pays within the first month in settlement of a claim and then is seeking some type of contribution from another motor vehicle insurer within the next month. They are long before any of these things are occurring. It is the relatively unusual situation that goes to litigation, at least statistically. So where they're talking about that there need not be any judgment, the drafters of the Uniform Contribution on Tort Features Act make very clear that they're really talking about the situation before suit has occurred that is a typical situation. If you will permit me, I think that there was a fundamental philosophical misunderstanding that I think the court should recognize and consider. There is a reason why five of the seven courts of appeals have rejected the thesis that the petitioner is asserting. And in order to understand, we have to step back a step. Starting in 1799, in Meriwether versus Nixon, all courts in the common law said there is no such thing as contribution. The word tortfeasor is simply a foreign language version of the English word wrongdoer. And the courts will not assist a wrongdoer. That was the fundamental thesis. That wrongdoers are not entitled to any consideration from the court because they are wrongdoers. That gives them no special status. The exception to that common law rule that did not recognize the right of any wrongdoer to obtain anything because they were a wrongdoer came in the form of the various contribution statutes, most of which are at least close to the Uniform Contribution Among Tortfeasors Act. If you'll forgive me, I did this history. I was the plaintiff's bar representative in this legislation. And there is a...
In 1791?
No, sir. This was in 1976.
Yeah, I understand, Mr. Mark.
The Negligence Committee. This is a bill of the Negligence Committee of the Ohio State Bar.
But since then, what happened is the General Assembly has seen fit to say, it isn't fair to let two people beat up on one and only one person respond. So they decided to pass this, codification of the common law.
I'm happy, Your Honor, and if you'll give me that moment to think, what they said is, and what the Uniform Contribution on Tort Feasors Act Committee said is, that where there is unjust enrichment, the party that bestows unjust enrichment on another wrongdoer should be entitled to recover because of his unjust enrichment.
And indeed, that is the precise language that, or close to it at least, that the commissioners used.
And while you're getting that, why isn't your party unjustly enriched?
Because our party was long before this dismissed and had to be dismissed because there was no claim by the plaintiff that was seizable.
Because of the statute of limitations. Let's go back to that issue a moment, because that's the one that's bothering me the most, and I'm tracking your argument. Obviously, I've read the statute backwards and forwards, as well as the other sections that you haven't put up here. But there may be a reason why tortfeasor one doesn't want to buy a third-party complaint or a mandatory joinder, bring in another target defendant. Maybe you should have thanked them for not bringing you in. I mean, here you'd be in a position where you'd be sitting in two chairs saying, oh, he did it, and the plaintiff says, fine, you're all bad.
Fine, and that was indeed either the plaintiff's prerogative or the co-defendant's prerogative, but to wait 5.5 years after the death to assert this third-party claim is not very fair to the third-party defendant, and that's what's going on here. That the contribution defendant is first brought into this action in a meaningful way 5.5 years after the death. Not 2.5 or 3, but 5.5. This is the language from the official comments of the commissioners on the corp state law. And it says, this is talking about this precise section, which is the section that for us is 2307.31b. The tortfeasor who settles removes himself entirely from the case so far as contribution is concerned if he is able and chooses to buy his piece for less than the entire liability. If he discharges the entire obligation, it is only fair to give him contribution from those whose liability he has discharged. Not that the law has discharged, he has discharged. And this is the unjust enrichment concept that is the exception to the common law rule.
Well,
I think counsel, all know the fundamental principle.
Counsel, the rules don't require this this doctor or doctor similarly situated to bring in everybody else that's potentially in the case.
They do not require they permit.
That's what I'm saying.
Now, as a matter of tactics, perhaps not in this case, because obviously the plaintiff was trying to get some drug manufacturer in here and just didn't do a good job of it in a timely fashion. But
they didn't sue the hospital in Melbourne.
Right. But as a matter of tactics, the hospital and or the doctor could, in a situation like this, be saying, we just didn't make any mistakes. This poor woman was in such fragile condition that there was enormous risk to undertaking this procedure. We explained that. She knew she had to have the procedure or death was going to be inevitable, so it was a high-risk procedure, and she lost that risk. And that's going to be our defense. And bringing in a drug manufacturer and into this case and trying to put into the mix that there's a drug out there that is inappropriate for this procedure, and we used it, is counterproductive to our first line of defense and what we think will be a successful defense.
So you're saying this was their strategy decisions.
They don't.
They
do.
Will seriously disadvantage the party that they're eventually going to say is at fault and blame, that they are going to withhold the knowledge they have, because certainly this is an excellent case to see that the defendant had enormously more knowledge about whatever could be the complaint regarding this drug than the patient and the patient's family.
But they settled it.
Well, they settled several years later after.
Okay, they settle and then they ask for a trial as to whether or not the drug is for the drug manufacturer there's some responsibility.
But they knew all of this, whatever it was, and they said, we're not going to assert these claims until after the drug manufacturer is lulled into a complete sense of security, because it will be several years later before we'll bother to bring it up against them. We're going to pull back. And
well, I thought they
have, that fundamentally
I thought they have, they have a year, do they not? After, they have a year to
no, go. Sir. I'm sorry. That's the problem that the petitioner has. There is a time limit and also a substantive requirement. If they have no substantive claim, it doesn't make any difference when they're asserting that claim. No one denies that the petitioner has filed within the period allowed by the statute for statute of limitations purposes. That's not even an issue. No one is challenging that they are timely. We are saying that they have no substantive right, that they did not enrich our client at all.
You would agree in the big picture sense, and you've worked on all these uniform laws on a number of them, and you share the same goals that this court ought to have, and that is to further the administration of justice in as efficient and inexpensive a manner as possible.
Third-party practice is clearly the way that should have been done. That is clearly the most efficient, that is clearly the most timely, that is clearly the best for everyone involved. It is, when everyone has the freshest knowledge, it is in one form, it is clearly the best.
Can't you foresee hypothetical situations in which it is counterproductive to settlement as occurred here to drag in everybody into that first case?
Only to the extent that you are alert to people that you're going to say have some responsibility so that they have a proper opportunity to defend themselves. If you can conceal from those people their potential risk, I agree with you that you can sneak up on them and catch them.
Well, perhaps a better way is to put them on notice that they're to change these statutes and rules and say, well, if you're anticipating a third party being brought in, put them on notice that may be in wings, but allow them the option as to whether or not they bring them in, so long as they give notice, so that your client is aware that this...
Clearly, the best way to do that is procedurally available is third-party practice. If we at all ascribe to the principle that the courts should narrowly construe any statute in derogation of the common law, then we must carefully apply the limitation, which is not only, by the way, in subsection 31b, but is also in 32c, the precise statute in which they rely upon, which says that they have discharged by payment the common liability. So this is a situation where the statute clearly expects and demands that requirement. Justice Douglas asked, isn't it necessary to comply with the procedural requirement of having the other name in the settlement agreement? The answer is yes, but why? Is it just so that we can fill up the paper? It is because that is to serve as a discharge. It is not simply to say, well, as a formality, you must put that name in, even though they have no liability. You're going to get a release for them, even though they have no liability. And as the petitioner here points out, they specifically asked Hoffman LaRoche, that is, MetroHealth, asked them, do you want to be protected in this release contract? They said, no, leave us out. We're done. We're finished with this case.
You need to wrap up, sum up, Mr. Marcus.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have the considerable other that I wanted to cover. I would suggest that there is a reason why, as indicated already, the courts insist that the release contain the name of the party being discharged. And it is not so that the paper will have more writing on it. It is so that the release, in compliance with both 230731B and 230732C, will extinguish, not already has been extinguished by something else, but the release itself will release, will discharge, will extinguish. That is the requirement of the statute. I ask the court, please, read the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Marcus. Mr. Wallard, you've saved 40 seconds.
I didn't even notice my red light was on before you're on.
No, it wasn't. You'd have 40 seconds before it came on.
See what you can do with 40 seconds.
I'll be very brief. 40 seconds worth. In point of fact, this notion about bringing a third-party claim is a red herring. With all due respects, the only Hoffman LaRoche party in the lawsuit turned out to be a corporation that had nothing to do with Versa. Was Metro to sue them and find out later? same position. When the complaint was filed against Hoffman LaRoche, it was already too late, the amended complaint, for Metro to do anything. I urge the court to answer both of the questions in the affirmative. I've even suggested that it's within the inherent power of this court to reduce that to a single question, and I suggested what that single question should be, rather than the repetitive and argumentative one drawn by the respondent.
Or a single word, yes or no.
Or a single word, yes or no. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
Before you sit down, I have just on this option of the roads, they sued one and it wasn't the right one. Is that right?
That is correct.
So Hoffman LaRoche, the defendant here, wholly unrelated to the other one, or
he owns the other one.
Okay.
So, and I'm not saying that the trial court made the right decision in letting Hoffman LaRoche out. I think there might be a civil rule 15 relation back.
The first,
it wasn't a final order.
But the first suit was in a timely fashion.
The first complaint was timely as to Metro. It was timely as to the other.
They got the wrong defendant.
They got the wrong defendant, and now are attempting to take advantage of that.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.